You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
Hello, friends. Good to be back with you. By myself. I think I just messed myself. That's a line that was often repeated by my college roommate. It's from the Nutty Professor. My buddy Fadu Baby, who was kind enough to send a video tribute for my birthday at the request of the best wifey on the planet. I got quite a few of those from my buddies wishing me a happy Juneteenth this year. And there is no cooler gift than that. Because I'll have it forever. I've already watched the video compilation maybe three times. Let me give you a quick, albeit subjective, history of Juneteenth. This is from my perspective, because I couldn't give you the real history of it. But I moved to Texas halfway through my eighth grade year. And in the first semester of eighth grade, I took Louisiana history with a guy named Coach Ott. Big guy. He talked with a lisp. Coach Ott, because his name is A-R-T, and there's no hard R in Louisiana on any word. And Coach Art's son played football at McNeese State. And I remember him telling us one day that his son said that the movie The Program was as close to what college football is like, more so than any other movie ever made. And I really wish they'd make one about college baseball like that. Where's the Netflix series about LSU baseball? Wouldn't that be great? Coach Art's other son, whom they called Catfish, he was the best player in Dixie Minors, which was the Dixie Youth League for 9 and 10-year-olds. This would have been 1986. Dixie Youth is what we played in Louisiana. When I moved to Texas, we played Pony League. So I'm 6 years old. My brother was 10. And I'd go to his games to watch him. And I would tell my brother that one day I was going to be like Catfish when I was 10. So when I got to be 10 years old, playing for Domino's Pizza, sure wish I had bought the stock, used some of my allowance money to invest in their stock back then. But I was pretty good when I was 10, maybe not the best player, but let's say closer to the top of the list than LeBron is on the GOAT list. That is to say, maybe top 12 or 13. Not really. I'm kidding. Maybe I cracked the top six. LeBron. I don't like LeBron, obviously. And when I was 10, Catfish, then 14, was no longer the best player in my brother's league. I don't even think he made the All-Star team. So my brother would tell me, you are going to be like Catfish, saying that a lot of guys who are awesome when they're 10 aren't that good when they're 14, because everybody else catches up to them, puberty and whatever. And that served as motivation for me. There was no way that I was going to peak at 10 years old. So I could prove my brother wrong. So when I was 14, and this will sound a little braggadocious, but you're used to it by now. So at 14, my favorite player was Ken Griffey Jr. And I would watch him pimp the shit out of home runs. You remember that? He would hit balls into the upper deck with arguably the most beautiful swing, left-handed swing, probably the most beautiful swing there ever was. And then he gently placed the bat down behind him and watched the ball sail out of the park. Well, leave it to little me. Some days when I was feeling it and I would connect with one, when they would pitch to me, I'll tell you about that in a minute, I'd hit a ball that would sail over the lights in right center field, and I would do my best Ken Griffey Jr. impersonation. And as I was rounding the bases, I would think about all those years ago when my brother was telling me I wasn't going to be worth a shit. And if my brother's listening, he'll be hearing this for the first time. So my dad, it's funny, I hear my friends complaining about that dad at their kids' Little League games. You know, the dad who's too involved and living vicariously through his son. And I wondered, was my dad that dad? And dad, if you're listening, the answer is no. But I do remember when my dad one time got real, well, more than once, but he would get animated when they wouldn't pitch to me. He'd stand up in the bleachers and yell something like, come on, you got to be shitting me. Pitch to him. He's not Babe Ruth, for Christ's sake, which was true. And to be frank, instead of Brad for a minute, I may have peaked at 14. So all the internet tough guys saying, oh, you peaked in high school. I probably peaked before that, because never again was I the best player on any team I played for, high school or college. But let me tell you the icing on the cake, and I'll stop talking about myself after this. When my brother got on the mic at my wedding, one of the things he said was, Brad was a playground legend, and I would bet he has no idea, one, how it felt to hear that, and two, the role he played in it. So let's talk about sibling rivalry. That's where all this is going, because I've lived it, and I've studied it, and I find it fascinating. Because sibling rivalry goes back to what? Adam and Eve's boys, probably? Well, definitely. They took it pretty serious, I would say. There's a great book by Ernest Becker called The Denial of Death. It was written in 1965, so it's one of those that stood the test of time. And in the book, he argues that sibling rivalry isn't a childish or trivial thing, but it's what he called a profound reflection of the human condition. He says sibling rivalries aren't due to the selfishness of a kid, that we're all born selfish. It's all about me, 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 right? When you're little, kids have no qualms about being self-centered. I want this. I want that. I want it now. My daughter said three times yesterday, are we there yet? And maybe something, I'll tell you a little bit about my parenting style. I don't know where I get it from, and it's probably not the way you would do it. But if you tell me you want to be a big girl, great. Let's get you on the hot seat. Grab a mic. No, I'm kidding. But, well, I did that. Yes, but seriously, since she's always talking about wanting to be a big girl, I knelt down with her at eye level, and I said, Boo, if we were there, you would know it. And I could see the gears turning. And what I'll do next time when we're headed somewhere, I'll say three times, are we there yet? And if I know my daughter, she will turn to me and say, Dada, if we were there, you would know it. Before I talk more about Becker, when I heard my daughter say on the podcast what she wanted to do when she grows up and why, and by the way, my wife and I had never heard that before, so I don't know where she got it. She said she wanted to be a dentist so that she can help others. And don't let me get verklempt, but her desire to serve others might be what I'm most proud of. And it tells me that although my parenting style is unique, I got to be doing something right. But Becker talks about how selfish and domineering a child can be, but says that sibling rivalry comes from a desperate need to feel like you're somebody of primary value, that you want to stand out and be first in the universe and to represent all of life. His words, not mine. He says when natural narcissism is combined with the need for self-esteem, to think well of yourself, it creates a young person who wants to be constantly comparing themselves to other kids to ensure that they're not second best or worse, left out. We all know how it feels to be picked last or being the last one standing there. And they're like, okay, you go to this team because it's their turn and they don't want to pick them. It's like going out and playing softball for the first time. Even though you played baseball all your life, they'll stick you in right field and you'll hit last. But the sibling rivalry, he explains, is all-absorbing and relentless and expresses the core human desire to be recognized as special and significant. That the struggle isn't merely an aberration, but it strikes at the heart of what it means to be human, the relentless drive to justify oneself as valuable and meaningful. And that comes through competition, often excruciating competition on the daily. And I say excruciating because kids get hurt. I know I did. Well, that's all we did, my brother and me, was compete constantly. And being forced as a kid to compete with somebody 4 years older than me, that was only going to make me better. So a lot of the awesome experiences that I've had in life can be directly attributed to having an older brother who kind of forced me to level up starting at a young age. And, you know, all the home runs that I've hit in my life, I actually remember the one that my brother hit when he was 14 years old. I remember it better than any of mine. He had kept the home run ball on his top shelf in his room, and I would go in there just to look at it and admire it. And then I'd grab a bat and a tennis ball, and I'd head outside to bounce the ball on the cement and hit it as far as I could. and then go retrieve it and then do it again. He also sent me a video for my birthday. Said that he was in Alabama working on a more athletic golf swing and that he thinks about me a lot and how I'm always pushing people to be the best version of themselves. And I love that. Iron sharpens iron, even within the fam. So, can't imagine doing life without him. Shout out, big bro. Love you, Cheek. But ladies, if you're looking for an awesome gift that costs no money and it'll mean a lot to your man, you don't need to do naughty stuff. Hell, you should be doing that on Tuesday and Wednesday. But for a birthday gift, have his buddies send a video wishing him a happy birthday from wherever they're at in the world. It truly was like the best gift ever. And like I said, it doesn't cost anything. I got him from H-Town, New Orleans, Nicaragua, Florida, Turks and Caicos. That was former guest, my boy Rutt. He definitely won best background. He was on the beach and it was gorgeous. Where else? Costa Rica. Second best background goes to Dano. Got one from Oklahoma City. Congrats to the Thunder on their Game 7 victory. They beat the Indiana Pacers, but that's not why he was there. Old Chaser's been in baseball so long. I actually remember him wishing me happy birthday for my 32nd. And he was in OKC. And he joked that if the Thunder had won, he was going to walk outside his hotel room and climb a light pole. Maybe I'd see him on the news. But LeBron and D-Wade, they were too much for Westbrook and Kevin Durant. The new Rocket, Kevin Durant. That's exciting. Although he's somebody that should have stayed off of social media because Durant was always the quiet, unassuming type, right? The unassuming star. And he started perhaps showing that he may be the tallest little bitch in the alive. I guess the temptation to tweet, to respond to your critics was too great. I don't know. Speaking of birthdays, how genius of it was Facebook to allow for people to tell each other happy birthday, which gets the other person to log in, to respond. That's so smart. I'd be curious to know, how do you decide whether to wish a Facebook friend happy birthday? Is it how close y'all are? It seems like if you're real close, you would text them or call them or send a video. But if they're just kind of a friend, you might not. And then if you barely know them, you probably wouldn't. Is that how most people decide? The way I used to do it is if there was only one person I knew who had a birthday that day, they were getting wished. But if there were four or five, no wish, unless it was, of course, my top dogs. And then I know their birthday in my head. I don't need a Facebook notification for it. But I actually changed my MO. I try to hit the people I've never wished happy birthday before. And have you noticed people don't really take the time anymore to personalize their HBD? And that's more Facebook engineering, making it more easy for you to wish that person happy birthday. So probably, hopefully, more people are doing that. They get more eyeballs on the app that way when they make it easier. I used to just say happy birthday sometimes and not personalize it if they weren't a real good friend. Just because I know, just sharing the way I think, I know that some people feel better the more people wish them happy birthday. So if I can help them get to 1,000 or 100 or hell, even 10, you know, I want to help them get there so they can feel good on their birthday. But yeah, most people do it now just by clicking a button. And you can tell because it says happy birthday, Brad, with the default three emojis. And before I really thought about it, I was like, wait a minute. You've never called me Brad in your life. Well, that's my name on Facebook. So that's what's going on there. I opened Facebook this morning and it had me reminiscing about how good we had it before it turned into an advertising app and a Reels app. I counted on average 6 posts about BS that I didn't care about before I'd see a post from a friend. Sometimes it'd be 5 ads and then sometimes 7. But if you've wondered why Meta stock is $700 a share, wonder no more. Instagram's the same way. But that was the good old days, which always serves as a reminder, of course, that there's something about life right now that's so good that we're not fully appreciating. And that these two the days we're living through now, someday we will consider them the good old days. And I try to remind myself of that every day. I took a picture of my daughter last week with a view in the back, and we had climbed a church tower to get this incredible view of Tallinn, the city where we're staying. And I said to my wife, you know, one day, today is going to seem like a very long time ago. And it forces you to appreciate the day. But enough about that. So I just want to say I appreciate every single one of you who took the time out to wish me happy birthday. It was the best one I've had since 40. And that was when my wife surprised me to tell me I was going to be a dad. So the funniest meme I've seen recently was a clip of a comedian saying that black dudes can give each other a hard time by just describing the way somebody looks and adding looking ass. And I thought that was hilarious. It could be anything, like no facial hair looking ass. I thought I was done talking about myself, but maybe that's not true. I shaved my head recently. First time I've ever done that. And I probably won't do it again because now I know I've got an ugly head. And I didn't realize I like having a little bit of hair up there. Little bald head looking ass. Did you hear Carter 6 is out? I talk about Lil Wayne a lot. You got to know if you're not on Carter 6, we are not the same. And I'm not sure what you're waiting for. If you need motivation, let me tell you, you'll never be as good as Catfish. Carter 6, Demon Time, 666. Man, why do you talk about black people so much? Black culture. I don't know, because I miss them. I'm in Estonia. I came here from Poland. I haven't seen a black person in a long time, since April. I was going to say coon's age, but I've noticed some people don't know what that means. Same with coon ass, but some people dumb. Let's talk current events, and then I'll tell you a little bit about Estonia, life in Estonia. I posted a reel on social media where I asked my guest, Dane Larson, he asked me if I've been following what's going on in the Middle East. And I said, yeah, I don't follow world events at all, Dane. Which, of course, if you're a regular listener or you've been to manoverseas.com, you know that I was kidding. Well, some dipshit on Instagram commented saying that I was the height of ignorance. So I clicked on his profile. It was private, but I could see he was bald like me. So I told him he was the best looking guy to ever call me a dummy. So I got that going for me. But my take of what's going on between Iran and Israel, let's talk about that. I saw where the enemy within, the communist mouthpieces on the three-letter networks, were saying that Americans were misled by Trump. No, Americans are being led by Trump. I've never seen leadership like it. Remember how I said I feel bad for those who don't find Trump funny? I also feel bad for those who don't recognize strong leadership when they see it, or the negotiating masterclass he's given us, or just communication skills. If you study it, there's so much you can glean from that. We just witnessed probably the most impressive military operation the world's ever seen. We had stealth bombers flying from Missouri undetected to blow up Iran's nuclear facilities, which were buried underground for a reason. Well, that reason doesn't mean anything to the most powerful military in the world, obviously. The U.S. military used technology that had never been used before, as far as I know. These bunker busters, also known as MOPs, which stands for Massive Ordnance Penetrator, it was just 30,000-pound precision weapons designed to penetrate the earth before blowing up everything underground. In addition, I believe we fired missiles from submarines. There were 75 precision-guided weapons unleashed. Trump said earlier this week, when Israel decided to unload all of its missiles, that it must have had ready to launch before the ceasefire was to start. So they rushed to see how much damage they could do before the deadline. Trump was not happy. And understandably so. I mean, if I were Netanyahu, I would not want to be on the receiving end of that ass-chewing that he certainly got after that. Because Trump doesn't curse much, but when he does, it's well-timed and emphatic. Netanyahu, it surprised me doing that. I'm sure it surprised all of us, because he's also smart as a whip and a master communicator. Did you see what he said following the U.S. strikes? The way he complimented Trump, he said, America, or maybe he said Trump, I don't remember which, he said, is a friend like no other. And he added that we worked as a team, as perhaps no team has ever worked before. Who does that sound like? Those are Trumpisms. So that's some of the best politicking you'll ever see. But sending missiles into Iran after the ceasefire deadline was announced, that was boneheaded, I think. And Trump told reporters, speaking of the F-bomb, he said, Israel and Iran have been fighting so long, they don't know what the fuck they're doing. Which is epic Trump, the most transparent president we've ever had. Because you know that's exactly what he's saying behind closed doors. So at a time when we're craving authenticity, because there's so much fakery nowadays, especially from the communist dramacrats. And that's not my term. It's a Scott Adamsism, dramacrats. So I can't take credit for it, but what a perfect name for a party that is all theater. We see it every day. You see that senator who tried to get at Kristi Noem, who got handcuffed and, well, they removed him from the meeting or the press conference and handcuffed him, which I'm sure is what he was hoping for. And then at the press conference following his arrest, he was crying. The only people you see crying when they get arrested are drunk women and this Padilla fellow. But Trump is rightfully pissed because he's got an opportunity to do something historic for peace in the world. The sort of thing that would get him a Nobel Prize, a Nobel Peace Prize, if he were a leftist. And yeah, his closest ally in the Middle East is flirting with ruining it. Don't do it, BB. And Trump, the marketer-in-chief, Trump, he even branded the conflict the 12-day war. How good is that? Knowing it ended quicker than the 13 days war, which was how long the Cuban Missile Crisis went on. But yeah, strategic use of the F-bomb is always better. If you use the F-word constantly, it diminishes its value. You know that when you say that word emphatically, like if you're pissed, it actually relieves some of your anger or frustration. Just the word. And when you think about it, it makes sense, right? If you said sad or, you know, something like that, or lisp, you know, that doesn't get it out. But when you use that word, I can't even think of an F word like fat. It doesn't feel as good. So it's incredible. It's kind of like punching the pillow. You go outside and just let the world have it, and then you feel a little better. Did you know Israel bombed the gate to the Evin prison where political dissidents are being held by the IRGC? I don't know if that worked, if Iran's J6er equivalent got out, but how about the symbolism there? Netanyahu has talked about if you're going to have an uprising in Iran, now's the time to do it if you want regime change. And then he takes out the exit door to the prison filled with dissidents. There is so much cool stuff going on if you're paying attention. I saw an article where Iran is planning a victory celebration, which they can get away with because they censor social media, so the truth doesn't get to its citizens. I believe they can use a VPN and work around it, but for the most part, they're tuned in to their version of MSM, mainstream media, which is, I'm sure, plugged in, you know, to propagandize the public. Don't know if that sounds familiar, but they did. So they retaliated, striking an American base, but they gave Qatar or Qatar, however you pronounce it, they gave them a heads up that it was coming, and there was no injury to any American, which is what they did when Trump took out Soleimani with a precision strike with a drone. So yeah, I imagine they're propagandizing their citizens like our government does, but you know, there's so much we wouldn't know had Kamala been elected and they continued to censor us like it was 2020. And let me say too that if stealth bombers taking out Iranian nuclear facilities was the most awesome military operation ever, I've got to say, what started all this, October 7th, 2023, that had to be the biggest blunder in history, the biggest FAFO we've ever seen, at least in my lifetime. It was so stupid. What else is going on in the world? Trump Mobile was introduced. It has a $47 a month plan with unlimited services and a $499 as a basically $500 T1 phone. It has a 6.8-inch Android screen that's available now for pre-order. I'm not going to be the guinea pig on that, but it sounds appealing. OpenAI secured a $200 million contract with the U.S. DoD to develop AI systems for national security purposes. And that explains why Sam Altman was kissing the ring a few months ago. X Money is going to be a thing. They're developing a physical debit card with Visa. It has customized options and peer-to-peer transfers, so you can send your friends money a la Venmo. And so they're trying to be the everything app. What else in technology? Meta teamed up with Oakley on a new pair of sport-focused smart glasses. And what it can do is record 3K video. It can play music. It can handle your phone calls and respond to your AI prompts. And that starts, what are they charging? $399 for that. It's going to be available July 11th. Supposedly, it has double the battery life of Meta's Ray-Bans. I haven't used any of that. But the WNBA, I never thought I would spend time talking about that. But it turns out you don't have to be ugly or a lesbian to play in the WNBA. The trio, affectionately now known as Tres Leches, Tres Leches, is about to get paid. Three white chicks. You know the game and how it goes. They're about to get chose. Thanks to any, many decisions. Did you know, when accounting for intelligence, that blacks and whites in the U.S. make the same money? That's pretty cool, right? Proving money doesn't accrue to stupid people. So take your racism and all that money you've got and shove it, Rachel Maddow. Or reparate it, even better. But yeah, masculine women will destroy us. I've touched on that before, because they don't know how good they have it. They're not grateful. And, of course, masculine men who are competent have been under attack for a while now. Mostly white men who are competent. Pete Hegseth, prime example. Being a stud guy, great communicator, ladies' man of the past. Of course they tried to take him down on the fact that he's had sex. But, you know, they treat... It's like their brains treat fewer problems as more problems. And that's a modern phenomenon. As we encounter fewer real threats in the world, we don't become happier. We instead lower our threshold for what constitutes a problem. So we have the same stress levels as our predecessor humans, but we get stressed out over trivial things now. And the way it works, so let's talk about dopamine. We're always either spending dopamine or investing it. So, and that's in everything we do. So for example, if you binge watch Netflix, or just instant gratification thinking, where you think you deserve the house that your parents live in now, or you're doom scrolling, that sort of thing, you are spending dopamine. Or you can invest dopamine by going to the gym, doing work that forces you to expand your mind, forces you to grow, having meaningful conversations. If we spend too much dopamine, it's going to kill you softly with his song. But early humans, as we know, face serious challenges. But in all the modern conveniences we have, the lack of discomfort makes us less resilient. But we humans are designed for struggle, not comfort. That's why we feel fulfilled when we struggle. That's why the good life feels unsatisfying, because most of us neglect to even realize it's a good life, and we're not embracing struggle. We're not embracing boredom. We see boredom going away, not realizing it's a feature, not a bug. And it's forced us to realize how valuable that time was when we were bored. But now, just about in every idle moment, we reach for our phones. And yeah, boredom is something we should embrace, try to get back to it. You have to choose it now, right? Sitting in stillness is what often precedes your best ideas. When you're just walking, your thoughts occur to you, like in the shower. Yeah, we're always trying to escape mental friction and we're worse off for it. When you have low friction activities like endless scrolling and instant entertainment at your fingertips, instant gratification, that's hijacking our reward system. And then when you have high friction activities, whether it's learning a new skill or doing something difficult with your hands, or just engaging in conversations, which people are doing less of, engaging in deep conversations especially, all that builds the sort of lasting satisfaction and fulfillment that we ultimately seek or should be seeking. And the paradox of all this is that while all the little conveniences of modernity foster comfort, it's actually destroying our chances at long-term fulfillment. So we've got to live deliberately. Choose the harder path, that is investing in the future you, rather than constantly distracting yourself. Let's talk about what it's like in this part of the world. It is wonderful. Yeah, I mean, you wonder why America can't be more like this. It is so clean and nice. The people are great. I'm in Estonia, just to note. It's walkable. Public transportation is excellent. They're also clean, the buses and trams. They run on time. You pull up the Maps app. It tells you which bus, what time, where to get off, how far of a walk you have once you get off the bus. It's all such a smooth running process. We're staying about a 10-minute bus ride east of Old Town. So if you're vacationing, this is what I tell people. I recommend staying in the Old Town. So everything's walkable. You'll have limited time. And that goes not just for here, but Warsaw, where we came from, Prague, where we're headed, and just most European cities where there is an Old Town. But we're living, L-I-V-I-N, not necessarily on vacation. So I like to stay with the locals and get a feel for the people and culture, and I feel like I learn more that way. And then I go to an office to get work done, like they do. So much like Warsaw, they have an Old Town and then an area with modern skyscrapers that are the Old Town and the modern skyscraper area where business gets done is just a 10-minute walk, and it's just awesome. We're also about a 15-20-minute walk from probably the most gorgeous park I've ever been through, just to arrive at a beach. And the temperature, well, although the temperature in June here hovers around 60 degrees Fahrenheit, so there's not much swimming, but you're on the Gulf of Finland. So just sitting out there, you can see cruise ships in the distance. You can see the ferry that'll take you to Finland in just 2 hours, which we plan to go on Saturday. So check out my Instagram stories if you want to see Helsinki. And yeah, of course, I'm into the history of all this. Tallinn, the city we're in, that's the capital. It has the Occupation Museum. I went last week. It tells you all about the Soviets invading here in June of 1940. In fact, they annexed all the Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. What happened was Nazi Germany under Hitler and the Soviet Union under Stalin, they made a pact before this happened, August of 1939, that basically allowed the Soviets to move in, to invade and occupy the Baltics. And although they annexed these countries, making them part of the Soviet Union, most Western countries didn't even recognize that. They said it was illegal, and they didn't even recognize the whole ordeal. By the way, the pact they signed was a 10-year non-aggression pact, which of course wasn't worth the paper it was written on. As I always say, you can't do a good deal with a bad guy. And in this case, you had two bad guys making a deal. Two bad guys for which the U.S. had to eventually decide which they were going to side with, which of the Satans we were going to ally with to defeat Nazi Germany. And as you know, we chose Stalin. So in violation of this worthless 10-year non-aggression pact, it didn't get rectified for a long time. The pact was called the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And I'll talk about Molotov here in a minute because I know you recognize the name. But in 1941, the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. And a few days later, they did the same to the Baltics. So Estonia became part of the Third Reich during this Nazi occupation. This was 1941 to 1944. And then in 1944, the Red Army did what's called the Baltic Offensive, and they recaptured the Baltics for the Soviet Union, and then began their reign of terror, which lasted till the fall of Soviet communism in 91. So as I said, it took a while to rectify all this. But, you know, in talking to Estonians, what they tell me is that they're very much concerned that Putin wants to reclaim the former Soviet bloc countries, especially the Baltics, because I guess they feel that would be easier than trying to take Hungary and Czech back, or maybe it's just because it's so close. I mean, I could get to St. Petersburg from here, Russia, in maybe 3 hours, and the border's even closer. But I'll be talking more about all that with my next guest, my special guest next episode. Did I ever tell you this? When I was in Europe in 2016, I would walk down the street, like in Germany, and I would hear F Donald Trump just randomly. It happened more than once. Well, here in Estonia, 2025, there's an attitude of F Putin. And you see it on signs in the old town. You see it on billboards. And just people telling me that in conversation. But, oh yeah, I was going to tell you about Molotov. So it sounds familiar because he's the man for which the Molotov cocktail is named. And of course, they're still used today by communist losers in the States. But the origin story is pretty cool. So it was actually the Finns who coined the term, Finland. And back when the Soviets were using cluster bombs and other incendiaries against Finland, Molotov, at the time, he was known to be one of the slickest, most awful statesmen there ever was. And he'd said, I think it was it must have been a radio broadcast, that they weren't bombing Finland, that they were actually delivering food to the starving Finns, which of course was bullshit. And yeah, that sounds like something somebody on the board of USAID would say about how generous they are with our money, right? While fomenting chaos and riots, regime change, that sort of thing. So the Finns, what they did was they mocked the whole idea. They started referring to the Soviet bombs as Molotov breadbaskets. And then the Finns co-opted the term, a la Donald Trump with fake news. Remember that? One of Hillary's excuses for losing the 2016 election. I think it was probably excuse number 28, if I'm not mistaken. Excuse 28, she said Trump won because of fake news. And Trump said, I'll take that term and forever associate it with all the three-letter networks who supported your campaign. That's the real fake news. So the Finns, they started attacking Soviet tanks with what they called Molotov cocktails, which they said was a drink to go with the food. Pretty clever, huh? Big Finnish fuck you. Which Mr. Molotov didn't appreciate, because up until then, he was pretty revered around the world. In fact, Winston Churchill had said he was a man of outstanding ability and cold-blooded ruthlessness. And even the U.S. Secretary of State at that time, John Dulles, he said, I have seen in action all the great international statesmen of this century, and I've never seen such personal diplomatic skill at so high a degree of perfection as Molotov's. That asshole got what he deserved, and he'll forever be associated with what dummy NPCs in the States are throwing at Teslas. If the name John Dulles sounds familiar, that's because he was the brother of Alan Dulles, who was at that time director of the CIA. He actually served in that role until JFK fired his ass, asked him to resign. And what's cool about that, President Trump and all his candor, one time he shared how that goes down. What he does is he calls whoever's getting the axe into the Oval Office and he tells them, I need a letter. And everybody knows what that means. He's telling them that they need to submit a resignation letter. And maybe Trump will get a reality show after his third term where he points at contestants and says, I need a letter. Yeah, that won't happen. That job would be beneath a king. Speaking of kings, I've been gone a while. Are the communists planning to protest anything imaginary this weekend? So JFK got rid of Alan Dulles. You may know this story, but guess who was appointed to the Warren Commission to investigate the JFK assassination? Alan Dulles. I believe many people don't realize how bitter one can be after getting fired. For a lot of people who are fired or asked to resign. A lot of times there's a seething hatred that stays with that person the rest of their life. And then you see our media mouthpieces, people like Margaret Brennan or Anderson Cooper or the aforementioned Rachel Maddow. they all act as though the beefs of somebody fired are legitimate. But does anybody ever say, yeah, they fired me, but I deserved it. I was incompetent or lazy or, yeah. What's Madnow worth? Will she make $25 million a year? That's why she needs to reparate some of that. That dude, that dude must get paid by the word, huh? Or the effort old Rach makes to sell you on bullshit with all the faces she makes. Somebody should make a YouTube channel. This might make some money, where it's her show and they put up a picture of Elon Musk or some other successful straight white man, but it would just muted so you can only see the faces she makes. And then you'd get the gist of her news just by watching her face go wild. But if you think about some of the guys Trump has fired, like John Kelly or that Scaramucci fella who Trump fired after 10 days, remember he hired him to be his communications expert or something? If you've wondered whether that dude deserved to be fired, follow him on X for 10 days. He is at that level of douchebaggery that is rarely paralleled. Well, except maybe that porn lawyer, what's his name? Avenatti. They damn near had a boot cake with that dude on The View. Those chicks. I can't believe they're still on TV. But let me make this prediction before I forget. If Trump doesn't have the DC airport name changed, you know, one of the, I think there were three in DC, Reagan and Dulles, and I don't remember the other name. Oh, I think the other one's named after Thurgood Marshall, which is what the law school in Houston is named after, the Texas Southern Law School. But yeah, if he doesn't change that, I think it'll be done under a Vance presidency. So refer back to this episode in 2030 and send me a high five if I get that one right. Let's do a Gerwinder and we'll wrap after that. Since I released 20 minutes of conversation with my little one a couple weeks ago, I'll spare you some of the more funny moments we've had recently. I feel like there's probably enough comedy in that 20-minute conversation to last a while. And your feedback, by the way, has been wonderful. I appreciate it. I might need to make Aria D'Antonio a regular guest. All right, Gerwinder, Stockdale paradox. Speaking of paradoxes, the optimal state of mind is neither optimism, which leaves you unprepared, nor pessimism, which destroys motivation, but optimistic pessimism. By preparing for the worst outcomes, you increase confidence in dealing with any outcome and thus increasing hope. Something I included in the top 40 list I did was that you want to prepare for a crisis before it comes. That if you overreact, that's on you because it indicates you didn't prepare. And you might say, well, how can you prepare for something you don't know is coming? And I would tell you it's mostly a mindset. That's what we're talking about. There's no way that I could have prepared for the crisis, or crises, actually, plural. No way I could have known what I'd be forced to endure in late 2023, early 24. But there was no chance it was going to defeat me. And my mind had actually was pretty much taken away. My brain didn't work there for a while. But fortunately, there were years and years of doing the internal work to fortify my mind. And whatever I had left was strong enough that it saved me. And that's an argument for the importance of preparation. Maybe the best argument for preparation I can think of, at least as it relates to my experience, when you, let's say you're given a presentation or a talk, or you have an interview coming up, or you're an attorney preparing for trial, whatever it is, you want to prepare and prepare. Remember what Charlie Munger said, the will to prepare is more important than the will to win. And I believe that. Strong preparation will give you reserves. You want to prepare so well that your audience doesn't even notice what you missed. Because you're so well prepared, you've so equipped yourself with more than enough to succeed. I had a coach who used to say, if you're nervous, that means you didn't prepare well enough. And being well prepared is what gives you the confidence to succeed. How nervous would you be if somebody asked you to get on a stage tonight with all the lights shining down on you, making it a little hot? I don't like that. And they asked you to give a talk to an audience of, let's say it's an auditorium of 500 people. You'd be very nervous because you wouldn't have time to prepare. So prep work gives you the confidence to do well. And when you've done well, you get compounding benefits because you become more confident after you've done well. So you've added confidence for the next time you do it, knowing you have what it takes to succeed. By the way, I'm going to have a mindset coach joining me on the pod in a few weeks. Good Gerwinder. I don't have anything else for you today. Thank you for listening. If I can do anything for you, let me know. Oh, I do have 2 slots open if you're interested in one-on-one coaching with me. I'm biased, of course, but I would encourage you to try it. All I can promise is that I'll help to guide you to living a bigger life. Talk back at you soon. Thank you, folks.